I have to tell the people about the Patreon.
Yes, you do. Patreon.com/SMDB. SMDB, like so many damn books.
For just a dollar, you can join up and you get access to all the exclusive content that I record just for the Patreon. Also, you get to join the book club. Oh, there's so many damn books book club. It's been some of the best conversations I've had about books.
It really always sounds like a blast. I'll usually like come home and just hear like giggles coming from the library. So it's a great time. You should join.
And I would love to have more people join the fray.
You may or may not know that Christopher runs this whole show himself on the hosting side, on the technical side, everything. This is a one-man show, truly. He does it all. Support your boy, Christopher.
Even at the dollar level really helps. So join up. Patreon.com/SMDB. I'd love to have you.
Patreon.com/SMDB.
On with the show.
We can do this. We can swing this.
Can we? Where's my notebook?
Great. I don't know. Oh, underneath the food.
Yeah.
Which is new for us.
All right.
It's a new thing to juggle.
Okay, so do you want to, you ready? You can do it?
Yeah, I can do it. I can swing it.
So many damn books.
Hi. Hello. Welcome to
So Many Damn Books.
I am Christopher.
I'm Drew.
And today we have
Evan Hanksor. Our first
illiterate guest.
Well, first illiterate guest.
Thank you.
it's strange to not call him an author because you have written a cookbook.
That's true. Yeah, so, I have also published a poem upon one time. So,
oh, really?
Where?
Yeah, it was a long time ago. It was in the New Orleans Review, back when I was down at Tulane.
Oh.
Cool. Yeah. So I guess it was after I left. But anyway, yeah.
Evan is a chef here in New York. You got your start here in New York at La Conda Verde.
I worked there when I first got here, yeah.
For a few
brief months.
You came to Egg, which is where you still are. You also, you and George Weld have Parish Hall as well.
We had Parish Hall, yeah, for a couple years in there, and then we closed it a little over 2 years ago and moved Egg into that space, which is where it now resides.
Nice.
Where you are churning out goddamn delicious food.
All the time.
All the time.
I'm going to talk about the drink I made for you. I felt like I had my my work cut out for me on this one. But this one is, it's so I decided to go simple rather than crazy. I'm calling the Beehive. It's whiskey and then also honey whiskey and lemon and a little bit of just regular granulated sugar. And you shake that up over ice and you pour it over ice. You put a lemon wedge on top and you sip it while you, I don't know, do anything really.
Yeah, anything.
Sit on a porch. I feel like the ideal.
If you could manage that, you're doing well.
Yeah. Conduct complicated surgery, anything.
Oh, sure. I mean,
it pairs with all activities.
Please note, we do not recommend that surgeons partake.
And you also brought a snack.
I did.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the snack?
That's kind of what you do when you cook things. You're like, oh, I got to bring a snack.
Yeah.
I brought a Spanish omelet or tortilla española. I was in Spain a couple years ago and still haven't gotten over the food there. So I decided to bring it here tonight. It's just a potato, onion, and egg, sort of a saute-baked omelet with some garlic and smoked paprika mayo. And it's awesome.
Oh,
it's
yes.
so cheap to make. It's relatively easy to make and it's super delicious.
I'm loving it. Thank you so much for bringing it.
Yeah.
Let's move to, what'd you buy?
What did you buy?
Me?
Yeah.
All right. I'll talk first. So coming up, I think in July, the month we're in now, Valley of the Dolls has its 50th year anniversary. Saw this great book, which has pink, edges. This 50th anniversary version.
Facing pages? No.
I don't know what to call it.
It's not end papers.
Nope. It's where a decal edge would be. Instead, it's pink.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm very excited to read it. What did you buy, Drew?
This past weekend, Danny and I went by Unnameable Books.
Oh, which yeah. I feel like Unam Yabla. I love that place.
The last of the like major Brooklyn bookstores that I had to check off of my, okay, I moved to the borough, now I've got to check out all these places list.
Mm-hmm.
Where we picked up our copy of Ocean Vuong's Night Sky with Exit Wounds.
Such a good title.
Yeah. And then...
I'd guess that's a book of poetry.
Indeed it is.
Ding, ding, ding.
And then the other day, to balance that out, I bought Mark Danielewski's The Familiar Volumes 2 and 3.
How does that balance that out?
Because they're real big.
Okay.
And the collection of poetry is pretty tiny.
Yeah, that's... You have a weird idea of balance. Evan, what did you buy?
Well, today I was in Midtown, which I aim not to be ever. but I was there, and I was meeting my mom for lunch, and I went into the Barnes & Noble near the restaurant, and I bought The Emperor of All Maladies for $2, which was amazing. It was like on some crazy clearance.
Oh, yeah.
Which is probably because Barnes & Noble is like going to close and ruin the book industry.
But no, it's never going to close.
It's not. So I bought that. And then the other day at Book Court, I bought an Adam Phillips book called On Balance. He's like one of my spiritual leaders. He's like a British child psychiatrist who's written all these amazing books. And I had a copy of this and I gave it to my brother. So I had to buy a new one and it was there. So that's what I bought.
Nice.
Cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
One of the really cool things about Egg, and something that I knew about Egg long before I knew you, is the relationship that both you, I guess, and the restaurant have with literature and sort of like making the experience of having food. It's not just a meal.
Mm-hmm.
You've found very interesting ways to heighten the experience of sitting down for a meal and like tie it into culture in an interesting way. With the Table of Contents series, you very graciously came on board as a bellwether artist, one of the companies that I produce for, and did an amazing event with Heidi Julovitz about a year ago.
She wrote the Vanishers and also helped on Women in Clothes with Sheila Hedy. If you don't know Heidi Julovitz.
And The Folded Clock,
yes.
Which was the book of hers that I was like, whoa, this is awesome.
Yeah, that's a special book.
Yeah. I'm curious to know how you came around to doing that and like what the impetus was for starting to cook in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, George and I both, before getting into cooking, were in literature. He was, I always say PhD in like poetry, but I think in literature, candidate up in Boston.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, wrote poetry for years and was working on a book at the time he decided to open Egg. And I studied creative writing and philosophy at Tulane and was writing poetry and took cooking as kind of a gig I could do that would allow me to have my days mostly free and write and still exist, you know, in that world. And then I think for both of us, clearly cooking won out. it dominated. But I think we still bring some of the, like maybe the goals or the mindsets or approaches that we had for our writing or for writing and the way we engaged through it with the world to cooking. And I think when I started to understand that I could do that through food was when food seemed to become like a viable option for something I would do with my life. When I was first cooking, it's like, this is great. You know, you're making delicious food. You're feeding people. That's totally admirable. You're making beautiful plates. But it didn't seem like enough. And when I started to realize the way food acted kind of as this like a hub through which all these different things I cared about intersected, right? It was like the effect it had on community and the nostalgic nature of food and how it relates to our identity and economy and politics and culture is like, wow, this is like a really powerful thing. And not that I was able to like express that relationship that I was hoping to have with food in every cooking job or experience I had. But when I got to Egg and after I'd been there for a couple of years, I found sort of a kindred spirit in George. And I'd had this idea in my head since I was at Tulane when I was taking this class by a professor named Dale Edmonds. It was his last class he was teaching at Tulane after like 30 years. He called it Last Call. And nice. He just picked his favorite books and taught them.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I wasn't supposed to be in the class. I was like a sophomore, and it was supposed to be for seniors, but I just kept going to the class, and he's like, okay, you can stay. Which is actually, I think, how most people like get jobs in restaurant, like good restaurants. You just keep going until they like get tired of telling you no. We were reading The Sun Also Rises, and I would read this, you know, it was in New Orleans. So I'd read it in the backyard of a friend's house with a bottle of wine and like get pretty drunk and be like, oh, this food sounds amazing. And they're just drinking all the time. And like all the Hemingway things you do when you're like young and stupid. And I was like, man, I wish I could cook like or eat the food in this book. And years later, I brought that idea up to George. Like, hey, why don't we do like a literary dinner? And we did it. And we started with the Food Book Fair, which is a great event that happens yearly over at the Wythe Hotel. And we kind of used it as the closing event for that weekend. And the first book was The Sun Also Rises, and it was amazing. People loved the experience. It felt new, and there were a lot of interesting intersections between like the literary side of things and the culinary side of things that came together in ways I don't think either of us anticipated setting out to do it, but we've since kind of seen repeated.
Being a chef, affect your reading it a lot now, or ever since you started doing this, or even before?
Yeah, certainly it does. And the reading that I did as I was kind of becoming sort of like enlightened about food's role in the world and developing my relationship to it, things like Wendell Berry and Michael Pollan, like these like great writers about food, that shaped the reading that I was doing, was shaping the cooking that I was engaging with. But at the same time, because I was cooking, I didn't know anything when I started. I was truly like, just like faking it. Like I worked at this restaurant in Westport, Connecticut called The Dressing Room, which was a great, like super sustainable, like locally sourced restaurant. The chef there was way ahead of his time in the sustainability movement. And I somehow like walked in there, got a job because the person who was hiring, like, it was like, okay, great. You don't know that much. You won't have bad habits. We can teach you. And he's like, you can work the grill. I was like, okay. And I had probably fudged on my resume, like about like my experience. I'd worked really briefly at a po' boy shop down in New Orleans and like learned nothing except like super hilarious cursing, you know? And so I go in to work the grill. I'm like, okay, sure. I guess I can do that. And it's this like 6 foot long, like just wood burning grill. And you're like, I get the logs in the morning. We light the fire. We like build the fire. You like manage the heat, cook like meats, fish, vegetables, all these things in the grill. And I had no fucking clue what was going on. So the first night of service, like the exemplary story is I was cooking burgers and I was cutting them in half after I like put them together and like put them on the bun. I was like, okay, that looks good. You know? And after a little while, like pretty quickly, maybe a half hour, an hour or so, someone, I think the chef walked in and was like, who the fuck is cutting the burgers in half? And like looked over at me and was like about to yell at me. He's like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know. I thought that's how we were supposed to do it. Of course I didn't. Nobody cuts a burger in half unless you're a child. But at that point I'd kind of learned like, okay, it takes this long for medium, this long for rare, this long for, and like hadn't figured that out. So there's a lot of that. And I got way away from the question of affecting my reading, but I was reading as many cookbooks as I could to try to learn as much as possible in like a super condensed time. And then that affected my writing, and I got pretty upset about it because I was writing poems with like lots of food in them. I was like, this isn't serious work. Like I want to write about the human condition, not tomatoes and whatever. And then my first published poem was about a tomato, and that was that complicated things for me.
Just for our listeners who might be unfamiliar, you do the big dinners where you sort of make an entire dinner based around a book, but mm-hmm. then semi-monthly.
Yeah, we try to do these monthly readings.
Which yeah, are- and I've been to a couple now, and it's just, it's cool. You get two or three authors to come in, and you pull something, either an actual dish out of the book, mm-hmm. or some sort of like, in the same way, Christopher, that you sort of make a drink mm-hmm. inspired by a book. It's just fun to sit there and like the author will read a little bit and then you swoop out from the kitchen and you're like, and now here is this thing. And it's like, oh, from what they were just reading.
It's amazing the reaction. Like, and I think like we hope that it really enhances your feeling of understanding or like connection to the text, right? Because like you read things and you mentally taste them or have a sense of what they're like, but then to actually have that dish in to have to encounter and like confront that dish in front of you and to eat it and ingest it physically, it's like I wasn't really expecting to like have this closer relationship with this book, but all right,
yeah, it is a very intimate thing to pull that out and have that right next to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, it's been something that I've tried to do in my reading for a long time. We talk about this sometimes on the show, like having an orange when we were reading.
Oh, yeah.
Like Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, like eating an orange just because like they don't have oranges anymore and they mention that they miss them. It's like, haha. Yeah. I am
some people. Some people do it out of altruism. Some
you just
it
like
out
petty
of
with the characters. Yeah.
To each their own,
and to each moment their own. You don't right. know. How you're, right. You know. Sometimes you want to spite your characters, and sometimes you want to join them.
Well, it's true. It's true. It's one of the things we've talked about. Like one of the best parts about doing the reading series version of Tables of Contents is, you know, you get to talk with the authors afterwards about their process and about the role food plays in their work. And we get really interesting responses to, and I think in some cases, they're questions that maybe the authors haven't thought of like consciously because food just finds its way into things. You're like, why did I use that? Like, what does that mean? And talking about a fair number of instances in Sarah's book, for example, like food is not always a source of pleasure or like existing in a context of pleasure the way it generally does in our lives, and trying to translate that into the dish and not just like making something delicious where it wouldn't make sense for something to just be like delicious. Like if the scene that it comes from or the book is like more complicated than that, how do you express that in the food? And like, how do you, like, how much can you honor what's going on through food?
When you're talking about Sarah Novick, you're talking about her novel Girl at War,
yeah.
Which is literally a young child soldier at war. So that's whatever they're eating is a little different.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So why don't we pivot? You actually did a table of contents for this book that we read for the podcast. Yes,
yes, you did.
Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. And before we get to the table of contents, I do want to talk about first, I'll admit, I definitely had a bias from, you know, 14-year-old me who thought that this book was impenetrable. Mm. And, you know, for some reason, even though that opinion is a 14-year-old's opinion, it's something I carried over into adulthood.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the, and we've discovered this a couple of times, like super tragic part of our educational system is that you read these amazing books when you're young and then everyone's like, oh yeah, I read that. You know, when you're adult, you're like, yeah, I read To Kill a Mockingbird when I was in whatever. I read I was watching God. Like, it was fine. And and you're like, well, if it was just fine, you wouldn't be reading it. And like, it wouldn't just have you read it in school. And when I've gone back to cook from them, it's just like, holy fuck, these books are like I've left these books, both those books in particular, so shaken.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, really like thankful that I got back to them somehow, right? That this was a way to get back to reading those books, which probably I would have been the same way. Like, eh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read that. I have a low opinion of it.
Yeah.
I'm immensely thankful that I did come back to this book because I just, A, coming to it from having lived for a little while, which I think with a book like this is especially important.
Mm-hmm.
But also just like having read a little more, even a little more widely.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I had read this as even a senior in high school, I wonder if I would have had a different impression of it. Mm-hmm. Before we go any further, I guess for anyone who hasn't read the book,
yes,
or who read it in high school and has since been like, fuck it, it is the story of a woman, Janie Crawford. She has several last names over the course of the book.
And she's telling the story of her life.
Yeah, she's come back home after some sort of tragic event, and she's recounting to her best friend like, well, yep, here's what's happened over the last 30-ish years.
Yeah. I saw some shit.
Yeah. So why did you bring this to us, this podcast? Why was it time to talk about it?
Well, this book, there are a lot of layers, right? So we did the tables of contents dinner on this book, but why do we do that in the first place? It's a book I've been wanting to do for a while because I actually grew up for about 8 years in Maitland, Florida, the town next to Eatonville, where the book is set. And where Zora Hurston lived. And I hadn't gone back to read it since I was little. And after reading To Kill a Mockingbird and having the experience of that, I was like, I got to go back and read this book. And we had kind of done some books that had like a Southern vibe to them because Egg is a Southern restaurant and it sort of made sense. And things lined up in a really great way. I wanted to really get into this book and like do some more research about it before we approached it. From a culinary perspective, and even bringing it here now to this podcast and doing the dinner about it, there was like a bit of like concern about it, right? Like George and I are two white guys cooking from, you know, one of the great black women authors, trying to interpret and like bring out something, suggest that we have something to say about that book, right? Just like we would, like it's hard for us on the surface to suggest that we have anything really significant to say about this book as like three Brooklyn white dudes, you know, sitting around. And so I wanted to make sure, but I did have a connection to it, like a personal like connection to it, to the place, and like reading the book and hearing the names of things and lakes and whatever that I knew from my childhood, like I connected with it on that level immediately. So I was going down to Miami to do a dinner on a Gertrude Stein book, and on my way there, I spent some time in Eatonville and Maitland. You're just like walking around, like re-feeling the place, like re-feeling what Central Florida is like, going to Eatonville, which like as a child, like probably had almost no awareness of, you know, it was a town next to Maitland. It's like 90% black. Maitland's like 90% white. And there wasn't a lot of overlap. And it felt important to go back and kind of see what was really there and try to understand it in a more significant way before I was going to cook from this book. And I'm really glad I did because I met some great people there. I talked to a lot of people from the town, the docent who runs the Zora Hurston Museum down there. Just cool. learned a bunch, reread Zora's autobiography, Dust Tracks on the Road, reread this a few times. And it's just such a good book. It's like such a good book. I mean, from the first line, right? It's like,
it's so good.
So like beautiful and powerful. You know, ships at a distance have every man's wish on board, all the way to the end. Like there's an amazing balance of what could get into like, and I think, you know, she avoids it perfectly, like get into this kind of like romantic or like overly folkloric cliched descriptions or stories or whatever. But, she, you know, Zora herself was so well researched, knew so much about black folklore and was able to translate the feelings and the realities of that existence in this town, which was the first free black town in the US, you know,
into literature. Didactic.
Exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't feel like she's like, and then this happened. Like right. It never feels like that. It feels very much driven by passion and character.
Yeah. And throughout reading the book, like at different times, I felt like nauseous. I felt like near tears. I was reading this in the subway and like laughing out loud and like people around it, like uncontrollably, just like, there's so much humor in this book. It's hilarious. and there's a lot of great food, you know, so that's why we ended up bringing it to the dinner series. And you know, I just think it's one of those books worth revisiting, and I guess that's why I brought it here.
Do you want to talk about the menu?
Yeah. I can say that I was lucky enough to be eating at Egg while you guys were prepping for the dinner, and got to sneak a tea cake.
Oh, good.
Which I was like, this is the best possible sort of like joke for a book ever. Because I feel like tea cake himself would have been like, nice.
Yeah. So I hope so.
So there's three men that sort of shape the book. Uh-huh. She moves from one to the next to the next. There's Mr. Willicks.
Yeah, Willicks.
Logan
Willicks. And then there's Jody Starks, who starts the town and who's mm-hmm. definitely the mayor. Mm-hmm. And then there's Tea Cake.
Yeah.
Or Mr. Woods.
Right.
But he prefers Tea Cake.
So when we approached it for the meal, with a book like this, and also we found like with a book like To Kill a Mockingbird, where they're books with plenty of food and plenty of Southern food that's hearty and simple and like enjoyable and right in our wheelhouse as a restaurant. Like, we know how to cook these things and people would expect them when they came to Egg. There's an interesting, like, for us, it was an interesting question to consider, is like how to approach that side of the book, but also how to not reduce the book to the kind of like almost stereotypical like foods of the Black South or foods of the South. And you know, with this book, we had a couple courses that were pretty straightforward and comforting. We had a fried rabbit and beans course. They cook fried rabbit in the book, and mm-hmm. It's different. We serve fried chicken and rabbit's kind of a new thing for some people, so there's a little bit of novelty to it, but it's also something that people can get into and be comforted by. There were a couple courses that we served that were a little bit more, I don't know, interpretive, that didn't necessarily have to do with food, in the book. One of them was, you know, one of the great scenes and the images from the book is Joe standing on the dead carcass of Matt Bonner's mule, you know, after they drag it out of town, and giving this whole speech about like mule heaven. And we did a dish kind of based around the description there, which has like so much of the humor of the book in that line. It says, he spoke of the joys of mule heaven to which the dear brother had departed this valley of sorrow, the mule angels flying around, the miles of green corn and cool water, a pasture of pure bran with a river of molasses running through it. And most glorious of all, no Matt Bonner with plow lines and halters to come in and corrupt. This is like so amazing. And there's like, those small moments of transition, like between this like imagery based description of something to like just this like sharp, accessible, like familiar, like humor. I don't know. I think her balance in the book is perfect. And then the other course we did was the one that raised the most kind of question between ourselves, between Wait, George and I.
I'm sorry, what was that course?
Oh, sorry, that, yeah.
What was the course?
The course was dessert, and we did pasture bran with molasses river. So we made a bran nice. Cake that we baked. It had like bran flour in it and some dried fruit, and we baked it, but then crumbled it up and like spread it crumbled along the plate with some herbs on it. I think there was some tarragon. Maybe some mint. So it was like this green and brown, like a field, like a new field. And there were some other nuts and sort of grains mixed in there. And then we had a molasses caramel sauce made with some vinegar. And we poured that like over the plate and through the center of it. So there's like molasses sauce running through this pasture bran.
That's so
so it's kind of like, it's almost exactly what the description is in the book, but that description has nothing to do with on first reading with food, with something you would consume, right? So yeah. We're going to bring that horse heaven meal, you know, into our mouths. And it was weird. Like, it was so weird to like cook and to plate. And even the flavors were like not like objectively delicious, right? It was a little bit more like challenging.
An experiential.
But the experience of it, I think a lot of people, like many people said, that was one of their favorite courses of the night. And then another one, which I think was probably my favorite course to conceive of and cook that night. And a lot, and I think the most powerful chorus of the meal was a visual representation of this description after Janie and TK have gone after the storm. Spoiler alert, there's a hurricane. And after the storm, there you know, tons of bodies to be buried. And basically TK gets caught by some like white authorities who are rounding people up, mainly black men, to bury the bodies. And there are descriptions of them taking these totally like disfigured, unrecognizable bodies, like to the point of like they don't know what race they are, they don't know if they're male, female, whatever. And they're burying them in pits, and the white police officers, whoever they are, stop the workers and like make sure you separate the white and the black bodies. And like, well, we can't tell which one's which. How can you do that? And why? And they say they're making coffins for the white bodies, and they're just throwing the black bodies into the pits. And they eventually have them look at the hair. They're like, oh, that's who you can tell. Look at the hair, and like separate the straight hair, you know, whatever. And there's just like, there's not a lot of discussion in the book of the racism of that time. You know, it's like kind of, because it's set in an all black town, it's kind of like cordoned off in a way, you know. I really wanted to cook something from that scene because it seemed like that was a part of the book we couldn't leave out, right? We couldn't just cook these books, these dishes of pleasure, moments of pleasure in the book where they're sitting down and sharing a meal and having a good time and the fire is warm or whatever, that sort of like feeling that exists at many points in the book. So we did a dish. We made a grits cake. So we cooked some grits and set them in a pan and cut them into rectangles and floured them and fried them. And it had this like light sort of pine colored exterior. And these were the coffins. And then we had roasted hen of the woods mushrooms, which are, if you've seen them before, maitake or hen of the woods, is like kind of skeletal, like brain looking mushrooms. You pull them apart and they're very oddly shaped. And they kind of had this like splayed limb effect to them, and roasted them, and they were dark. And we had a leek ash that we put on top, and a like a reduced pork sauce or something. So these like wet, dirty, soggy looking mushrooms, they're delicious. But the plate was certainly the most stark of the whole meal. And so everyone reads, the way I should have said this before, like the way you encounter the meal at first is when you sit down, you don't have a menu. You have a stack of bookmarks, and each bookmark has the passage and the course. And so you kind of reveal them as you go along, and you read the passage, and then you see the brief description of the chorus underneath, and then you're served it. So, you know, the people who are sitting down in this room read the passage of the burial and the coffins and the discarding of the black bodies. And it's like kind of like a, you know, sort of thing to read. And then this gets set in front of you. It's just like a stark, like, you know, basically looks like a coffin and a body. And there's like a, you can see in the room, just like having that set in front of them and like being challenged to eat this and enjoy this, is like a intense experience.
It's intense just to listen to.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have a preconceived notion of this book because of high school and have even read it in high school. I'm just going to say, like, change that idea of it and reread this if that's where you're at. And if you just, you know, you somehow missed it because you weren't in that class in high school for whatever reason or whatever,
or
it was,
decided not to read it.
Yeah. We've
all been there.
You copied off your,
you skipped straight to the blowing it up in the mailbox.
Right.
Yeah. You just read Spark Notes. If you did that, you know, I think it's, check it out, because it feels completely modern. Like, the idea that it was written in 1937 is insane. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, it reads like anything that, if you said this book came out 2 years ago or whatever, I would. Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't, it's completely and utterly timeless.
And, you know, coming from her, like Zora Neale Hurston is like kind of this timeless, certainly well ahead of her time, you know, woman. It's kind of not surprising. But it's very reflective of, I don't know, her honesty and her disregard for what might have been expected of her or writing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It does that thing that you always hope classics will do, where it doesn't matter when it was written. It mm-hmm. speaks straight to the truth of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's move to recommendations. Huh?
Yeah. Speaking of the have you heard of?
Yeah. Drew, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I have another one. We were talking a little earlier about Hemingway, and this year I have been, since I didn't read any Hemingway in school, I didn't have to, and I also, for whatever reason, never thought, like, this is something I ought to read anyway. Wow. I just read, I finished it on the way here and, like, actually burst into tears on the train on the way here.
Been there.
To Have and Have Not, which, it's about a guy sort of doing smuggling runs between Key West and Cuba, right around the time of the revolution in Cuba. And it, like, there's this, it's a good thriller. It's like a good sort of like proto, John le Carré sort of like thriller. But then the very end of the book, he all of a sudden just like does this sort of Virginia Woolf-y thing of like spinning through a bunch of people's heads as they're all sleeping in these boats in the marina. And like, spoilers, the last boat that comes in has like this guy who's hanging on to life after like a shootout with some Cubans on the high seas. But as he goes through these heads and like talks about their struggles and their strifes and their happinesses and like the people who have died because of certain people and the people who have lived because of other ones, it was the first moment with Hemingway where I was like, oh, he's not just an amazing writer, like the actual act of writing. He knew some shit about humanity. And it's one of those ones that like is never mentioned in the first breath of Hemingway, but I definitely recommend it. Evan, how about you?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, I'm reading 1004 by Ben Lerner right now.
Nice.
It's pretty sweet. I really like that. I'm not all the way through it, so I'm not sure that I can recommend it entirely, but I can recommend reading at least half of it so far. I guess I've been recommending, it's what I said I bought earlier, but Adam Phillips, if you haven't read him and are looking for like ways to really fuck with yourself, it's a very direct way of doing that. He has a bunch of amazing books. Probably the first one I would suggest to read is a book called On Kissing, Tickling, and Being Bored. And
done. Yeah. Sold.
I mean, it's like an amazing title also. but he has, yeah, tons of books just partly about, or at least incidentally about his, some case studies, but then it just moves into, it's like Oliver Sacks sort of like, but I think even like beyond in the depth that he gets to.
Can you recommend a cookbook or something that you're
definitely
cooking from?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So The Basque Book by Alex Raj. She has Chiquito and Lavara and El Quinto Pino and a new restaurant called Tecoa. Two of them down in my neighborhood, and is a good friend of mine and an amazing cook. I love Basque food. You can definitely get a recipe for the Spanish tortilla in that book. Also, Brooks Headley's book called Fancy Desserts is one of the best reads of a cookbook that you'll ever find. His voice is so good. He's like a punk rock drummer turned three Michelin star sort of or two Michelin star, whatever, like amazing pastry chef. And just the stories and the tone of these, some of which are like extremely fastidious, like fancy dessert recipes written from like, yeah, so like fuck everything, like sort of like punk vibe, is amazing. And then one of my favorite cookbooks ever is called Roast Chicken and Other Stories by a British chef named Simon Hopkinson. It's one of the first cookbooks I ever really cooked from down in New Orleans. I made like my first fancy meal for my girlfriend down there. Like, it was so cliche. It was like whole roasted heads of garlic like spread on bread, and it was like, look how amazing I am. But the voice in that book is really comforting and hilarious and British. And right now, maybe we need to hear some British voices.
Especially the comforting ones.
Yeah, right. Not the ones we are hearing, which are the crazies. Yeah.
Um. Chef, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. This was really fun.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for...
I feel more literate already.
Thanks for recommending this book. I mean, it was great to revisit it and realize that I never really visited it the first time.
Yeah, this is... This made me... This changed my life.
The restaurant's like... Butter or shell or what is it called? You think it would be the easiest name to remember, but it's too easy.